everybody, and welcome back to another spoiler review with me, A Border Prince. Today we are discussing Man Flayer by Josh Reynolds, the final book in his mighty Fabius Barr series. So if you don't want spoilers for this novel, or for the rest of the series, or for heresy and other stuff, you need to go away now. And before we delve into it, we had better do some admin. The author, the great Josh Reynolds, which many of you regular viewers know I am a big fan of, no longer works for Black Library, unfortunately. So we must consider ourselves lucky that he has finished this series fully and closed the arc. It is a bitter pill, though, as we aren't going to get the same amazing treatment for other characters that he's worked with, such as Lucas the Trickster, nor a follow-up to the Apocalypse novel or any more of his Cal Jericho. This hurts, as I feel like Josh was one of the best writers in the Black Library stable, and it's honestly shocking they didn't do everything they could to keep him. But I'm not an insider. I have no idea what goes on there. It's just unfortunate that we have lost this dude. So, it's a loss to the 40k universe, but he has finished the Fabius Barr series, and in my humble, well, not that humble, my utterly correct and objectively true opinion, Fabius is now one of the most fleshed out and relatable characters in the lore. Relatable isn't the right thing to say. I definitely do not agree with Fabius Barr's visionary use of ethically terrible, horrific genetic manipulations of people and the terrible things he does. No, definitely not. But yes, it is a loss to us all, and I know many of you will agree. I wish Mr. Reynolds the best of luck in his future literary endeavours, and I suggest you check out his website. The link should be showing up now, and will also be in the description as well, so you can keep a track on what he does next. Well, whatever that is, it should be awesome. Hopefully. And also, lads, let's have some Fs in the chat for old Josh. Respect. So, Man Flayer is the third novel in this series. If you want to enjoy this book, you will need to read the two previous novels, Primogenitor and Clone Lord. Otherwise, you will not have a bloody clue what is going on. Not only that, you will need to read or listen to the four short stories, A Memory of Tharsis, Prodigal, Light of the Crystal Sun, and Repairer of Ruin. But also, because Josh, for some reason, treats the reader like an adult, and hasn't written this for normies, you will also need to read the Lucius the Eternal novel, The Faultless Blade, and the first Black Legion novel, at least. But read both of them, they are good. Oh! And at that point, you should probably read the Fulgrim Primarch's novella Reynolds wrote to get his vision of the Primarch and Fabius in the Great Crusade, as this will shape how you understand later events. It's a great novel on its own, and has a lot about dueling and perfection in it, and provides essential foundations to the culture and belief system of the Third Legion. And also, perhaps, has Fabius Bile taking the first samples that he would used to create his Vatborn later, which is a nice touch. I say Josh treats you like an adult, in that throughout the series, characters mention things, make jokes or offhand comments, and if you haven't read this supporting literature, then you ain't gonna have a clue what they're talking about. He manages in all his novels to make the characters come to life and feel as if they are living in this universe, with actually understandable and relatable personalities. And he bothers to actually link together characters and events, enabling you to submerge yourself in this vast universe, where what happens in one place matters, to a greater or lesser extent, than things just happening in isolation, like a lot of Black Library books do. This is easier to do with characters like Fabius, because you have more to work with, as their lives begin all the way back at the start of the Great Crusade, or the Wars of Unification. But a lot of authors just don't seem to be able to achieve this in the same way. Not to mention, Josh never allows his characters to make stupid decisions and choices that they should never make. But that's a whole other video. Is it fan service? Maybe. Sometimes. But it's seamless and also fun, and adds depth to characters when their relationships with other well-known characters are mentioned, or when one character makes a joke or does something hilarious. The audiobook as well is fantastic. It's pure quality in terms of production and narration, John Banks is an insanely skilled narrator, and I have learned a lot listening to his work, and he does not disappoint in this audio, and transports you to the world fully. I've heard some things about some of the newer audios Black Library have released, saying they aren't the best, to be frank. Banks gets it. He understands the universe and represents the characters perfectly. I'll give it a 10 out of 10. So yeah, Josh Reynolds was one of the most skilled authors there. And this skill and ability was displayed in the Fabius Ball series, a series which he wasn't that fond of, or at least about a character that he wasn't that fond of. And the fact that he still managed to achieve this is astounding to me. It is one of the best series GW have ever produced, novel series that is, or Black Library I should say. And I am immensely happy to have read it. It's added so much depth for me to the universe in terms of how characters interact with each other, their belief systems, how they view the universe. It is just pure quality and stands up for me with the best that Black Library has produced and is the rarest of things, a complete beginning and ending of a story. Well, kind of an ending, but we'll get to that later. I just want to say, Josh's characters feel the most real out of all, pretty much most characters I've read about. Other authors are able to achieve this, you know. But, I don't know, Josh has a sort of flair for this, and comedic timing as well. But they're in-universe jokes, you know. They're in-universe jokes, and that's hard to accomplish, to make those kind of things funny. And, yeah, the characters are just, every one of them has an individual personality. It isn't just generic Ultramarine shooting Necron, or something equally as banal. It's clever, and it's interesting, and it draws upon a lot of really fascinating ideas in a really fun way. Ideas that some people might think are a bit too, I don't know, controversial in other contexts. But in this, it's able to make them interesting and fun. And I think revelation-wise, or lore-wise, Josh Reynolds is responsible in his work for some of the most, I don't know, really, really, I don't know what the best word to use is. I should have written this bit down. I don't know if you can tell. Deeply lore-affecting revelations, bits of lore, facts, little factoids. It's too good. Anyway, press F for Josh. Right, now, that's all out of the way. Let's talk about the final, kind of, adventure of the last sane man in the universe, Fabius Bile, Man Flayer. The book opens with us seeing the moment when Fabius's daughter is dancing, surrounded by Slaaneshi demons in her quest to seek a boon from the demon Primarch Fulgrim. She is almost slain, but Narvo Quinn from the Heresy saves her, and this is his introduction to the series. A marine that died in the Heresy, whom Fabius brought back to life like he did Eidolon. And straight away, you need to have an understanding of the post-Heresy Emperor's children and what happened, otherwise you won't know what's happening. Narvo pops up later, which we will discuss later. But the main thing is the fall of Melusine to demonhood. She did it to save Fabius. A misguided attempt, I suppose, but is part of the current that runs through the series. Love for Fabius, for the benefactor, for the primogenitor, pater mutatis, by his creations, and Fabius's love for his creations as well, or at least his love for his gene daughter, which comes on unexpected to him, which, in his crazy mind, transmutes into the idea that she needs to be protected, which eventually spawns into the idea of creating the new men. At least this is a major contributing factor to that, it seems. It does to me, at least. Especially after she is lost, as he throws himself into the project completely. No matter how he rationalizes the decision by saying the Legion is lost and humanity on the whole is too weak to survive in the galaxy. Also, and I would offer this as the first example of world building, we have the following interaction between Melusine and Fulgrim, which not only is amazing character development, but also places us into a point in time in the universe.
You look like him. I doubt anyone but myself can see it, but it is there. His skull beneath your skin. His eyes. His disdain.
He brought his face close to hers. Small eyes sprouted on his cheeks and brow and fixed upon her. His breath smelled of something sour, overlaid with sweetness.
You think you are my superior, don't you? Even in this moment, so close to destruction, your arrogance is astounding.
He drew back, a cruel smile stretching across his two perfect features.
Some traits breed true.
Melusine did not reply. She tried to meet the multifarious gazes of the demon prince, but could not. The smell, the colors, it all served to make her eyes water and her lungs burn. She wanted to collapse, to sleep, to die. Instead, she stood and waited.
I killed my brother at Thessala, Fulgrim said softly. Not the one I loved best, or the one I loved least. The one I knew nothing about. The one I did not concern myself with.
He was no longer looking at her.
And yet, it bites at me. As if something is wrong. Regret is a part of desire.
Fulgrim stiffened.
What did you say?
Regret is as much a part of desire as satisfaction, Melusine said, her voice cracking from fear and exhaustion.
And desire is what you serve. Yearning, need, and want.
She sank to her knees, head bowed.
I come in yearning, Lord Fulgrim.
This one section, to me, is just peak 40k. So, we have a point in time that links immediately to the recent battles with the Ultramarines following the Great Scaring, and just says so much, so simply, about Fulgrim and his view on the situation. Brilliant. Earlier, it calls back to Lucius's claim to have killed her, and Narvo's desire for him to return and help his sons as the Legion Wars are going on. And again, straight away, Reynolds throws us deep into the universe, but not with pointless exposition. We are viewing a moment which links to the wider universe and simply, but brilliantly, develops these characters. Melusine becomes a demon as part of the bargain, and so begins her part in bringing Fabius, her father, to salvation, or at least the only kind of salvation he can get. She does this out of love and will sacrifice anything for him, even her soul, which he will too. It's like poetry. It rhymes. The rest of the novel splits and follows Fabius and company, and then his opponents, the Dark Elder, Zakari, Homunculus, Hexakaires. Now, this gets complex, so bear with me. I'll try and explain this as simply as I can. I love this series too much, so I've had to be super concise, otherwise this review would get crazy long and become a rambling mess. Hexakaires is after Fabius because he escaped from Kimura after learning the Coven's secrets and literally eating these records, which somehow he was able to imbibe using his omophagia gland thing. This series of events was mostly covered in the Lucius the Eternal novel that I mentioned previously, so you need to read that. Now, he's out for revenge and has been aided by the Harlequins of the Mask of the Veiled Path, led by the constant tinkerer with fate, Salandra Veilwalker. She has given over to the Zakari Oleander Coe, a former pupil of Fabius's, who had been left to die on the craft world of Lugunoth once his collaboration with the Nightfears had been revealed. So that's the first novel. Anyways, since then, he has been the pet of Hexakaires, who has been torturing him for entertainment, because essentially the Dark Eldar are psychic vampires, feeding on the pain and torment they cause in others. That's the simple way of putting it, anyway. Hexakaires is torturing him in ever more bizarre ways for the lols, which Oleander, being a devotee of Slaanesh, means they are essentially getting off to each other. So aside from entertaining each other like this, Oleander has been giving over information as to the location of many of Baal's cash worlds and locations of members of the Consortium. Hexakaires has gathered a force of lesser cabals to aid him, who are in it for the loot and the rewards and the prisoners, you know, standard raiding force stuff. Being an ancient homunculus, however, and being the leader of a fairly large coven, he has access to a number of esoteric and OP weaponry that he is happy to use to aid the raids and to plunder these worlds, while all the time he himself is looking to goad Fabius into action. It's here that we get one of the things that Josh is good at. Nice, subtle conversations between characters that tap into something, I don't know, I want to say deep, but that sounds a bit pretentious and ridiculous. But anyway, it's good. You will enjoy.
So many statues, Peshik murmured. Why do they need so many? Short lives make for short memories, Hexakiri said idly. They need to be reminded of their history on a nigh-constant basis, otherwise they'd forget everything.
Peshik shook his head in bewilderment.
How such a dim-witted species has propagated itself to such an extent, I shall never understand.
Hexakiri laughed, an ugly, oily sound.
Intelligence and fecundity are two distinct spheres, and there's something to be said for sheer momentum.
The purpose is to draw Fabius out from his hiding place by attacking his supporters, worlds under his control, and destroying his gene caches. Places where he keeps resources and also clone bodies of himself. One of which will be his resurrected body, should his present one die with his consciousness and soul being sent or transferred into another one using Eldar psyche tech magic stuff that's been mentioned in previous novels. This is all at the instigation of Veilwalker, who is attempting, and has been since the first novel, attempting to push Fate, and Fabius in particular, into a certain future. To that end, she has sacrificed the craft world of Lugenoth, and now, using Oleander, pushed the Dark Eldar to a final confrontation with Fabius, which will require him to make a choice, which will determine his fate, and somehow the ultimate fate of the Eldar race, for the greater good, shall we say? I mean, probably for the good. Who knows with these clowns? Veilwalker is a fascinating character and pops up in a lot of 40k stuff, some better than others, but is one of the lesser known instigators of a lot of what goes on in 40k, pushing the fates in a particular direction for their own ends, and we get some amazing conversations from her. We rejoin Fabius at his new hidden base of operations on the Chrome world of Baelial 4. Yeah, that one. Which he gained access to with the mastery of the Webway. I mean, he can just use the Webway opening lost portals and so on since the first novel, with the help of his Wraithbone-infused Eldar Prisoner Key. Well, that is too complicated to explain here, so I'm not going to. But I'll have a lore video on Fabius going over all this in more detail at some point soonish. Fabius has continued to grow and multiply his new men project, spreading them throughout the universe, where they essentially take over the worlds, subverting and infiltrating their power structures and bringing them over to him. It doesn't always work, we hear that sometimes they rebel, but essentially Fabius has dozens of operations going on which allow him to control swathes of Imperial space with these secret masters, allowing him to leech resources and conduct experiments, and also as caches for his clone bodies and just as hideouts. This reminds me of the Eisenhorn story, with that secret cabal of people who are also trying to eugenically alter the population, like a secret society that's running across that sector of space where Eisenhorn operates. It's an interesting thought that maybe they are connected, and that's probably what's being aimed at here. Not mentioned, but is a potential thing. Oleander knows about a lot of these places, even if his knowledge is a little outdated. It should be noted that this is all occurring in M31, so it's another nice touch from Josh that we actually get some dates. Anyways, this is where we get some awesome sciencey stuff and how Fabius views his efforts at creating a new and improved humanity.
The children were left to roam free where possible. They grew quickly and learned even quicker. Survival was hardwired into them. Only a few hours after birth, Homo Novus could see and hear as well as digest solid food. By a few days, they could hunt on their own, and he had the Vatborn ensured that the vermin population was maintained for just that purpose. At 6 weeks, their education began. It started simply enough, gradually increasing in complexity as they reached their first year. Those who showed an aptitude for the hard sciences or sociological studies were separated from the rest and taken for further training. The new man, for all its increased aggression, had an equal capacity for the retention and processing of information. They were smarter than their predecessors, as well as being stronger and faster. But intelligence took many different forms. Some proved to be natural engineers, while others had a startling grasp of human nature. Many were simply very adept killers. The species had yet to find an optimum balance. Initially, he had overseen arranged integration of select bloodlines in order to improve the general population. Sometime after the 12th generation, he had ceased, realizing it was largely counterproductive. His creations were perfectly capable of managing such matters on their own, and did not require his attempts at matchmaking.
And also, his plans for them in the future.
The Dark City had been an inspiration in more ways than one. It had shown him the value of an ultimate redoubt, a place in which a chosen people might hide from their foes until they were ready to take their place in the galaxy. But there was a danger to such isolationism. The Drukhari were a twisted, inbred race, wraiths haunting a galaxy they had once owned. Care would have to be taken to avoid such a fate. Years of work, of preparation, had gone into it, occupying all of his time and resources of late. But he had done it. And now it waited, silent and empty, but for those few trusted servants who oversaw its day-to-day running.
Now, this whole thing hasn't gone completely to plan. Half of the new men, the Glandhounds, those who stayed with Fabius and developed into tribes and so on, descending from Iguri and that first generation of Homo Novus, rebelled to an extent when Fabius left on his pilgrimage to Kamora. They refused to be pets, and Iguri in particular was no longer happy with Fabius treating them like dogs and not allowing them to be what they were meant to be, his sword warriors. So her people now live in the wilds of the planet, having cut out a kingdom for themselves amongst the beastkin and monsters of the old crone world. Here, Iguri is visited by Melusine, who cryptically explains what's going to happen next.
Listen to me, sister. Listen. When the time comes, you must ignore your instincts, those wonderful, beautiful instincts that tell you to obey him. You must, else it all tumbles down, and us with it. He is the center, and without you, he cannot hold.
Upon learning of the raids on his positions and the hunting down of members or former members of his consortium, Fabius decides to ambush them, hoping to end the threat. He goes to one of his cache worlds, one that the new men rule, and this and other instances show the breadth and scale of Fabius's little empire and the power he wields, a whole imperial world, one of many ostensibly loyal to the Imperium but actually his. It also has a nice moment where the rulers tell him everything is going to plan. The native houses have been broken, infiltrated, and they are starting secondary eugenic modification of the population. It's too funny. He says he visits these worlds regularly to check on them, and often, as in this instance, posing as a loyal space marine, with the others in his entourage doing the same, cleaning up their armour and hiding it of their potentially disturbing ornamentations and so on. Or at least the ones that can pass for non-traitor marines do. His Death Guard mate, obviously being a devotee of the grandfather, will never pass, nor would his super-happy nurgly doggo beast, that is a giant slug that secretes slime that can melt steel, that's also called puzzles. This book has so much awesome and amazing character interactions and jokes, I just can't cover it all. I can't. Puzzles! Anyway, Fabius tells the rulers to prepare for invasion, and he deploys his own troops from the 12th millennial and Glandhounds, as well as a bunch of mutant and beasts and general riffraff he has gathered together for muscle. The 12th millennial is, of course, commanded by Savona, and she is an example of an awesome character that is a chick, but isn't forced or written by someone who doesn't know any women or acts like an idiot. I would say more on her as she is present throughout the story, to the very end, and has been since the start. But her relationship with Fabius, and more particularly with the gutter poet, are some of the funniest and most awesomely slaneshy parts of the book. She is a true hedonist. She and the gutter poet have got to be some of the funniest characters, with the various things he does and just general awesome loyalty to Savona. Now, the battle is going reasonably well when Fabius and Hexacares confront each other, but that turns out to be a trap as the Dark Eldar pulls out a dark light bomb thingy that basically wipes out half of Fabius's people before they can escape, and also takes one of his arms as the black hole singularity destroys the planet. After this debacle, Fabius has something of a crisis, with many of his followers deciding to leave, and he himself being lost and unable to work out what to do next.
Grandfather, bless me. You have no idea how to proceed, do you?
He shook his head.
The others were right.
Fabius's glare could have cut Ceramite.
I know how to proceed. I am merely gauging the variables of each possible alternative in order to select the optimum.
But his words were hollow, protestations born out of instinct rather than truth.
What you're describing is called indecision,
Korak said gently.
You forget. I stood beside you at Harmony, Fabius. Like Arian, I was aboard that ill-fated vessel when Abaddon boarded us and erased your work. And I saw what came after.
He tapped a thick finger against Fabius's chest.
I saw the pit you fell into. What becomes of the supreme strategist when his strategies are undone?
I have never claimed to be a strategist, Fabius said sharply.
No? Then what have you been doing for the past 500 years but orchestrating a grand strategy to save the galaxy as you see it? And now, for the first time, you face the possibility that it is all for naught.
You have no idea what you're talking about.
Korag sighed.
I am not so foolish as you seem to think, Fabius. I know the difference between you waiting to act and being unable to do so. For the first week after our return, I assumed it was the former. I assured the others that you had some plan. But I was wrong. Something has broken in you. Something has been broken in you since you returned from Kamora.
He paused.
Are you afraid of them, the Drukhari?
No. I fear nothing save failure.
Failure is what you are facing, Korak said. Everything you have built is dying, and there is nothing you can do about it.
He stepped back and sighed.
If this is the end, it is not a fitting one. I do not have it in me to endure this black lassitude of yours a second time.
He chuckled again and turned.
Still, I envy you, Fabius. Such despair you must be feeling, such hopelessness. Grandfather has truly blessed you.
Death Guard characters are so jolly in despair. It's great. He decides to stand and fight the Dark Elder, as he knows they will not stop. He begins to seek aid from others and reaches out to some amazing characters. Abaddon agrees to assist him, and we have a great moment between them and the mighty Faelbaddon, who always seems awesome in novels, but is like another character with what they do with him in the actual main strand of the lore.
How did you get a hollow projection all this way? Fabius said.
Abaddon's mouth was an ugly line.
A dozen of my best witches are working very hard to ensure that we can have this talk. This place is quite well shielded from prying eyes.
Fabius snorted.
Sorcery? Have you lost yourself to superstition then, Ezekiel?
Is that what you call it? Precise terminology was never among my skills.
No. Your talents always ran to the bloodier end of the spectrum, as I recall.
Fabius studied the sorcerous image of the man who'd nearly killed him.
The look on your face when I butchered that meat puppet of yours is a memory I still cherish.
He shook his head.
I was surprised when I received your gift. It was unexpected, given all that had passed between us.
Times change.
We don't.
Abaddon looked at him.
That is our strength and our weakness.
More one than the other, I think.
Perhaps.
Abaddon was silent for a moment. The air seemed to curdle around him. The trees leaned away, and their whispers had fallen deathly silent. The grove seemed to be holding its breath.
Well,
he said finally.
Well, what?
Aren't you going to kneel?
Fabius stared at him.
I do not beg. I will not kneel.
No, I didn't think you would, he replied. I'd heard you'd become little more than a ghost haunting a selection of clone carcasses. I gave it little credence at the time, But looking at you now, well, it seems the rumors were true.
He gestured with the claw.
This grove is a cancer. I would be doing the universe a favor if I excised it, and you. But you won't, will you? No, you are useful,
Abaddon continued.
And I never throw away useful things without cause. Without your skills, it is entirely likely that we would not have recovered from the Legion Wars. That I have an army is thanks in part to you.
He gestured to the ground.
Kneel, Fabius, and I will help you.
Abaddon was silent for a moment.
The gods speak to me, Fabius, whether you believe it or not. They tell me things. They promise me things. I ignore them, save when it suits me to listen.
He looked at Fabius.
We are more alike than you think, and that is why I tell you this. Do not accept whatever bargain they offer you. Walk unflinching into the fires of your extermination, even as our brothers did at Istvan. Choose freedom.
Fabius stared at him.
And what of my children? What of my legacy? It will die with you,
Abaddon said bluntly.
If the Xenos don't kill them, I will. But better death than whatever the gods have planned for you.
Abaddon finally tells him to seek out Narvo Quinn, who will lead him on a pilgrimage to find Fulgrim. Again, this is why you need to read the Fulgrim Primarch novel, as he was one of the original Terran Emperor's children, who, when the Legion was reduced to a few hundred, survived and led armies of mortals in the early heresy, and is descended from the military families of Old Earth. Fabius resurrected him after Eidolon, but he came back different, and, of course, we see him at the start of the book attempting to save Melusine, and it is she who convinces him to help Fabius. Hexachires, on the other hand, is in trouble. His allies have demanded a return to Kamora after the battle, as they suffered heavy casualties, and want to spend their winnings from all their previous successful raids. Plus, he is putting down a bit of a coup amongst his fellow homunculi. We get some good stuff on his attitude to Fabius and his own personal beliefs in the Eldar Gargineri, and that he is a believer in this. And bear in mind that this is back in M31, so way, way back.
To any other being, such a plan might have seemed mad. To Hexachires, it seemed only reasonable. Fabius was a kindred spirit. He saw the galaxy for the smouldering pyre it was. Like Hexachires, in his heart of hearts, he knew his people were doomed. Hexachires was under no illusions as to the eventual fate of the Drakari. They were on the slow road to extinction, much like their craftworlder cousins. Even the Exodites, in their primitive enclaves, were caught fast by the coming conflagration. They were fuel for the fire, nothing more. Unless something changed. As Fabius sought to reshape humanity into something better, so Hexachires sought to do that to the Eldari. Granted, their methods were not similar in the least. Fabius cared nothing for the Mon Ki as they currently existed. He intended to shape a better race to rule over the galaxy with their passing. But for Hexachires, the passing was all. For the Eldari to be preserved, they must first perish, and their souls be given over to the force known as Ined. In his youth, in the dwindling days of the Eldari Empire, Hexachires had never been one for gods. They seemed to be a bucolic holdover of a simpler time. But since the Empire's fall and Kamora's rise, he had come to know better. There were gods, and they were hungry, terrible things. But some were more terrible than others, and some might well hold the key to the rebirth of his people. Ined was one such, according to those who had taught him of such things. Only once all of the living Eldari were devoured by Ined, barring a dutiful few, of course, such as himself, could they be reborn anew, free of the weakness that had been their downfall. But among those who thought as he did, there was precious little agreement on how to accomplish such a thing. Some wished merely to wait out the inevitable conflagration, perhaps even nudging events along here and there. Others committed themselves to crafting exquisite pandemics, or weapons of such destructive potential that even Azdrubale Vect himself would balk at their use.
We also get some good stuff on his origins before the fall, from Veilwalker.
Creature, is it, O Lord of Knives? How rude, Veilwalker began. And after all I've done to aid you, Hexakyres Ulthiliad.
Hexakyres stiffened. Veilwalker laughed.
Yes, I know your name. Who you were before the fall of the Empire and the long retreat to Kamora. Just an artist then. A scribbler of pedestrian portraiture. Not even well known. And yet, look at you now.
Hexakyres drew himself up.
Yes, look at me. Whatever I was, I am now master of the 13 scars. And you are nothing to me, little clown.
Which for some reason reminds me of the Postman movie. With the general who used to be a photocopy salesman. I think someone else has seen the Postman. It's kind of the same. Additionally, none of this commitment and true belief in the Yanari. Again, this is 10,000 years before the rise of it. He is actually doing things to push the Eldar in that direction. He is altering the genetics of those Eldar he can, making them more stupid, more aggressive, so they die more, and so, in order to accelerate the decline of the race and speed up the birth of the god. I mean, this is major. He also discusses Fabius's plan for the new men on several occasions, and believes it foolish compared to his plans for the birth of the god, saying that it doesn't matter how much foreign genetic material you splice into a human, the beast flesh will win out. This is all amazing. Fabius finds Narvo Quinn, and we get some amazing quotes between the two, and Narvo's disdain for the spider, and what has become of them since the heresy and before. Narvo is convinced by the intervention of Melusine to help Fabius and the gang go on a pilgrimage to find Fulgrim. Eventually, after some awesome chaos stuff, showing the madness of demonhood, he gets to Fulgrim, and it is an amazing scene, and the conversation is so rich with depth.
Hello, Fabius. It has been an eternity, hasn't it? Father, Fabius growled.
He shoved away from the statue and spun, firing as he moved. Fulgrim sprang from his perch too swiftly to track. Torment connected with the golden blade, and the demon spirit bound within the cane screeched as Fabius was driven back. His armor servos whined as he struggled against his opponent.
You are quicker than I remember, Fabius, Fulgrim said. Have you improved upon yourself at last? Added a little something to the mix, perhaps? I did not come here to fight, Fabius said through gritted teeth. Clearly. Then you were never a proper soldier, were you? Always too busy cutting open your brothers to bother with fighting beside them.
There is talk throughout the series of Fabius being worshipped as a god, as Pater Mutatis, and the Dark Eldar mention that something is sprouting inside him, and maybe he, unironically, given his atheistic imperial truth beliefs and disdain for the dark powers, is becoming a god, having created so much life that worships him as such. A little god, but a god nonetheless. And this is the choice of Fabius, whether he acknowledges it or not. Also, it's interesting that the powers of the warp know this, too, and offer him this stark choice through Fulgrim. In order to save his new men from his enemies, but also from the chaos gods, Fabius must offer up his soul. Because unlike all the other great names of the damned legions, he never actually committed to chaos. He never sold his soul. His soul is corrupted and, shall we say, morally ambiguous, but it is his still. Now he has a choice. Give himself up to serve the warp, or he and his projects, his plans, his legacy, will, with this threat, or the next one, be wiped out eventually. This is what Abaddon was talking about. The gods have a plan for him, and want to enact it before the canker in his soul sprouts into something awful that they can't control.
You come here to ask for my help. This is my price. This is Slaanesh's price.
Do as you are meant to do, and your creations will be spared the coming storm.
We will take them under our wing, Fabius. We will teach them and guide them. I was the greatest of teachers in my day.
I look forward to tutoring them in new ways to shout, revel, and kill.
You will do nothing of the sort.
Fulgrim reared as if in shock.
But that is the bargain. The bargain is for their safety, from you as well as my other foes. My creations, all of them, will be left unmolested to find their fate as they see fit. And if they choose to serve us, as dear Melusine did?
Fabius was silent for long moments.
Then that is their choice. He looked up at Fulgrim. Unlike you, father, I have learned from my mistakes.
Fulgrim smiled.
And that is why you are my favorite, Fabius. Rather than making the same mistakes over and over again, you make brand new ones. It keeps things ever so interesting.
He turned, head tilted, as if listening to some voice that Fabius could not perceive. A moment later, he turned back.
Agreed. A good bargain.
Very well. Fabius turned. I will take my leave now.
Oh, no. Not yet.
Fulgrim swiftly encircled him.
First, a sign of fealty is required.
What sort of sign?
Fulgrim's smile was wider than his face. A moment later, the garden ceased to be. It blew away, like dust, taking with it Fulgrim and Melusine, leaving only the black and the stars between.
What must I do?
He asked in that moment of utter silence.
What must I do to keep my children safe?
In answer, something rose from nothing. A flat stone, as long as a man and wider by half, not carved by human hands, shaped instead by time and tide into a perfect altar. The first altar and the last, and on its flat surface, a knife. A crude thing with a blade of chipped stone and a handle wrapped in animal hair. Fabius stared at it. He looked up, but no answer was forthcoming. There was only a pregnant silence as the gods waited to see what he would do. He went to the altar and picked up the knife. It weighed nothing, and yet was heavier than any weapon known to man. He looked down. His armor, his coat, all gone. The chirurgeon and torment as well. He was alone. For the first time in centuries, he was truly alone. He examined himself with an apothecary's eye, the thinness of his frame, the way his flesh wrinkled against his bones, the rawness of the contact nodes, the liver spots, the stink of weakness.
A friend of mine has often told me that there are only two types of people, those who lie on the stone and those who hold the knife. I think I have held this knife forever. For longer than I can recall.
As he spoke, he brandished it. The stone became steel, and the knife became a scalpel, if only for an instant. He remembered his experiments, the faces of those sacrificed in order to buy him time, to buy him knowledge, freedom. The faces of his brothers at Istvan and beyond, of a thousand innocents on Terra, of his children as their world burned.
But now, it is my turn to lie on the stone, to ensure that the sun rises and the crops grow, and that my people are safe.
He climbed onto the altar and clasped the knife with two hands. It took a moment to steady it, to steel himself, though he had done worse things to himself many times before. He pressed the point of the blade to his chest. He barely felt it go in, but he felt what came after. Fabius screamed, and there was a sound as of a great wind roaring through unseen trees. Then, silence.
There now. That wasn't so hard, was it?
Fabius, bloody and panting, glared at his genefather. He rolled off of the altar and looked down at himself. There was no sign of the wound in his chest, and he was once more clad in his armor. The chirurgeon chanted into his ear. The garden spread out around him once more. Demons watched from the fringes, tittering with glee. Some he thought he even recognized. Creatures he had faced before and banished, now come to gloat at his surrender. Sickened, he extended the knife. It was still wet with his blood.
Would that I had the strength to flense your scales from your bones, father. I would teach you lessons of agony that you would never forget.
Fulgrim raised an eyebrow.
Fabius, I have never heard you speak so, he smiled.
Maybe you aren't such a disappointment after all.
This moment is full of symbolism. The stone where a father is asked to sacrifice. A father sacrificing the most important thing to him to save his children. A sacrifice of his worn, dark old soul to this god, despite a lifetime of rejecting the warp, in order to save his children. The fact that this is happening because of Melusine's love for her father, and to be honest, the messed up plans of the Harlequins, happy to make Fabius become a horror to the universe, and all the beasts and monsters he will create and the pain he would unleash for their own plans. It's really a story about love for children, to their father, and vice versa, but also the greed of other forces taking advantage of that love, that affection, and also a scientist trying to genetically manipulate a new breed of humanity, of course. Amazing. And again, Josh Reynolds is top tier. This is not your regular 40k Balter Porn novel. But we get some of that anyway. So, with the promised aid from Fulgrim, everybody prepares for the final showdown. But first, Igori and Fabius have a chat, which gets to the core of both of their issues.
Then prepare us. We are your weapons, benefactor. Sharpen our blades. Ready us for war.
She looked up at him.
It is all we have ever asked of you.
Fabius shook his head.
No. No, I have made arrangements. You will go. You must. Someone must see to your people in my absence. I can think of no one better than you.
He did not look at Meshana as he spoke, but he felt her eyes on him.
And I have said that I will not go. You will not obey him, Meshana barked.
Igori glanced at her, and a slow smile curved across her face. Her hand rested on her knife.
Do you remember when I spoke to you of my dream, granddaughter?
Meshana hesitated and bowed her head. Fabius looked back and forth between them.
Dream? What dream? What are you talking about?
Igori turned.
I saw you in a garden, benefactor. I saw you kneel before a silver serpent, and I saw your face as it struck.
She spoke slowly, deliberately.
You taught us to behead such serpents, and yet you let it strike you.
Fabius stared at her, unable to find his voice. She touched his chest, her face solemn.
She warned me of this, though I did not understand at the time. She? Melusine,
Fabius said hoarsely, trying to understand. He shook his head.
You do not understand. It was necessary.
She turned away.
As is this. Goodbye, benefactor.
She was gone a moment later. Fabius stared at the hatch for long moments. His chest ached as the memory of the knife grew sharp. He looked at Meshana.
I have a new task for you and your pack, he said.
You wish me to bring her back?
Yes. Bring her to the evacuation point by any means necessary.
She left us,
Meshana said, hesitantly.
So she did, Fabius said. But she is my child, as you are, and all your brothers and sisters. Some bonds cannot be so easily broken.
She tried to cut my guts out.
And you tried to do the same to her, I'm sure.
Meshana growled softly.
Are we dogs, then, to forget because you demand it?
The question was almost, but not quite, a challenge. Fabius sighed. She stepped back, eyes narrowed, tense. He stroked her cheek.
Yes, he said, gently. You are dogs. Hounds, bred for purpose, spoiled, perhaps. I have coddled you and your kind for generations, while others of your species have clawed their way to power on 100 worlds.
He caught her chin between his thumb and forefinger.
It is past time to remind you of your place.
As he'd expected, her hand went to her knife, but she didn't draw it. She had that much control. He released her.
Homo Novus has exceeded my expectations in almost all regards. Your genetics are a work of sublime artistry. With each generation, you grow stronger. But that strength is not often accompanied by wisdom.
He paused.
Save in one case. She is the best of you, even now, and I will not see her or you wasted in useless battle. So you will find her, and you will take her where she must go. Those are my orders.
He looked at her and smiled sadly.
Do me the courtesy of following them one final time.
The battle comes, and unfortunately our top man, Arion, dies. But he gets a good ending, and the conversation between him and his fallen brothers, who have been with him since the start, is truly meaningful, I think.
Your mind is wandering, brother. You lack clarity.
He turned. Breas walked beside him, and not alone. Telegar, Morgiv, and the others were there as well. He looked down at their skulls and saw that they were gone. Shattered, perhaps, when he'd been thrown from the wall.
If I were a superstitious man, I'd say it freed our souls. Then you don't believe in souls, do you, Arion?
Soul or hallucination, I am glad to see you, Arion said. I'm having trouble walking. Can one of you help me?
You know we can't, dog brother. No help for you now.
You always were a fatalist, Breas. Arion forced himself on. Something was definitely broken in his leg. It was like walking on shattered glass. He tried to ignore it.
Realist, Breas said. Dead men know their own.
Before Arion could reply, he spotted something moving in the smoke. As it thinned, he saw Rax stooped among the dead, taking samples. One spied him and pointed. Another issued a shrill cry, and several massive shapes bounded forward. Grotesques. Too many to fight, and too fast to escape from.
Looks like you're not going to make it to your master's side, dog brother.
Arion smiled. Slowly, he deactivated the chem pumps that controlled the flow of carmatives and pain suppressors into his system. The nails bit instantly, as fresh as the day they'd been inserted. He prized a sputtering chain axe from the grip of a dead war mutant. The weapon was heavy, but he lifted it easily.
It ends as it began, eh, dog brother?
So it seems, Breas, Arion said. Flashes of pain danced across his mind and coiled tight about his spine. His grin widened as a flood of adrenaline flushed the last of the carmatis from his system.
I always knew you'd come back to us.
Yes. Do you forgive me?
What is there to forgive, dog brother? Now, enough talk. There's killing to be done.
Yes. Arion revved the chain axe as the first grotesque loped towards him. With a howl, he leapt to meet it.
Without going into super detail, it's a pretty bloody battle. We have Ramos, the Bull of the Eighth, an appropriate title for a Noise Marine and a Slaaneshi worshipper, slaughtering Dark Eldar. We have Titans fighting against a vast flesh tower. We have Gland Hounds and Astartes fighting to the death. But ultimately, Fabius can't win. The final confrontation between the two surgeons of death is kind of anticlimactic, to be honest. Fabius tries to trick him with threats of a failsafe booby trap. If he dies, the ball's on this man. And Hexachires going on a rant, until Oleander, in one last move, caves in his captor's head as a horde of demons are unleashed on the planet by Sakara. Just on the word bearer, he goes for an amazing journey in the books and is one of my favourites, with his faith up against Fabius's faithlessness. But this isn't the end, no. Melusine and Agori, the first and second daughters of Fabius, his most beloved, they merge together into a possessed, I suppose, thing. Demon host type, I don't know, it's like a mix between the two of them. They whisk Fabius's nearly or fully dead form away. For though nearly dead, he is not quite. And now, in the end, we see what happened to Fabius. His clones are linked to him. But unlike before, where he would jump from fresh body to fresh body, he now spreads his consciousness across dozens of copies of himself. They are not him, but versions of him, all subservient to the dreamlike control of Fabius using Eldar Wraithbone technology. I'm not explaining this correctly. The book does it a lot better. But this is actually a ridiculously clever way of explaining how and why we have, in other books and in lore, seen such starkly different versions of Fabius. We had it explained early in the book that the Chirurgeon he uses has evolved to multiply, which is pretty gross when you think about it. But that means they are in ready supply. They are literally grown. And that although they all have a demon weapon called Torment, they are simply fakes, lesser weapons with other demons bound to them that the clone Fabius is simply called Torment. The pact Fabius made with Slaanesh, or perhaps it was with the powers of Chaos Undivided, was to create monsters and soldiers. That was his duty and his destiny, and that is what he has done. The other side was, of course, the protection of his new men, but not just the new men in general, but it seems also Melusine, who is his child, who is now merged with Aghori, and they seem to be his servants now, and she no longer seems to be a servant of Slaanesh and belongs to her father. I think that's what's been aimed at. Since the Battle of Balliol IV, Fabius has become a terror onto the galaxy, a true madman creating horrors undreamed of. But it wasn't really him. Not fully, anyway. It was one of the multiple different versions of him, and doing the messy work of bloodshed. But now, at the end, he wakes up, when presented with information on the Primaris, the true Fabius, either because he is healed from his wounds, is back in this new, dark Imperium.
A new phase of the Long War has begun, and the old gods have returned to stride the stars. Gilliman has returned, and he has not come alone.
Fabius paused.
How? Eldari witchery.
Skarlagrim held up a data slate.
I've compiled all the pertinent information here, at least everything we know.
Fabius took it and tossed it to Sakara.
And how did you come to know this? First-hand accounts, surviving witnesses, spies.
Skarlagrim hesitated.
That isn't the main problem, though. I should hope not. If anyone knows how to butcher a Primarch, it's Ezekiel.
Skarlagrim retrieved a small hollow projector from his belt and tapped the activation rune. A figure appeared, accompanied by reams of data.
They appeared suddenly, as if they'd been waiting for Gilliman's call. They wear the heraldry of our milkblood cousins, but they are not like them. They call themselves Primaris Marines, if that means anything to you. Nothing of any importance. And why are you concerned? They are larger, stronger, faster. Even veterans of the Long War are hard-pressed to match them. They are better than us, Fabius. Better in every way that matters. As we were better than the Thunder Warriors, Fabius said. Is it any surprise that there were yet more horrors waiting in the Corpse Emperor's laboratories? Aren't you concerned? Why would I be?
Fabius gestured, and the image spun slowly. He peered at the genetic data scrolling alongside it.
Is this information correct? I took those samples myself, off one of the few bodies we managed to recover.
Fabius dismissed the image.
Ezekiel wants something to counter them, doesn't he? How predictable. They make oversized warriors, we make oversized warriors.
He shook his head.
A galaxy of children squabbling over their toys. Opinions aside, can you do it? Of course I can. The question is, should I?
Fabius gestured to the projection.
Why should this interest me?
He paused suddenly and turned to the diagnostic beer. A moment later, he sighed softly.
Oh, I see. Very well.
He looked at Skarlagrim.
Stand back. What? Why?
The beer hissed as it vented waste gas. Skarlagrim hastily retreated as the Wraithbone roots pulsed and quivered. Alert runes flashed on the nearby screens. Key stood and laid a thin, clawed hand on the surface of the casket, as if to soothe the being within.
"Because he is awake,"
Melusine said. She turned towards Skarlagrim and gave a smile that was somehow wider than her face. She stepped back as the biocasket shuddered open, spewing toxic fumes into the air. Cyclers kicked on, drawing it up and away. Throughout the chamber, mutants abased themselves.
"Pater mutatis,"
they intoned the words with fatalistic reverence.
"Pater mutatis."
Wraithbone crackled and slid free as it was expelled from the casket. Alarms chimed.
"Pater mutatis."
In a geyser of nutrient smog, something as thin as a corpse rose from its crypt. Bloodshot eyes rolled in their sockets, fixing on Skarlagrim with predatory interest. Without thinking, he took another step back.
"Gods,"
he muttered.
"Gods," the dead man croaked. "There are no gods here save me. You would be wise to remember that, Skarlagrim, for I am not a merciful deity or a kindly one."
He held out a withered hand, and Sakara handed him the data slate. Fabius Bile smiled.
"Now, let us see what has become of the galaxy in my absence, eh?"
So, there we have it. A pretty comfy ending to a tremendous saga. As I say, the whole series presents us with one of the most fleshed out and interesting characters in the 40k universe, and even wraps up a bunch of plot holes. Now, is this a very convenient ending? Maybe. But it is a neat way of wrapping up the saga fully, while explaining why contradictory examples of Fabius exist in the lore, but also allowing the character to exist in the current era. As Fabius gave himself over to Chaos fully, it's fair to say that, like Lucius or other champions of Chaos, he is in a way immortal, or not quite mortal, almost a demon. Interesting to consider. The novel series is full of awesome and interesting ideas, and I know I've said awesome a lot because it's the only word I can really use. It has wit and humour unmatched in pretty much all of a 40k series. Josh Reynolds did this perfectly, and again, press F, boys. I have obviously skipped over a bunch of awesome moments and characters, but I had already left this too long, and if I didn't get it done, I would never get it done, so sorry if I missed anything important. I love this series too much, and I would spend days talking about it, but this is way too much information to convey, so I've done my best to be concise instead of ramble aimlessly and just laugh at how amazing things are. But there we have it. The last book in the Fabius Bile series, the last book from Josh Reynolds. Kind of. I've still got to finish Cal Jericho and do a review of that. But yes, a goodbye, but not really, to the last sane man in the universe. Thanks to everybody supporting the channel. I really appreciate it, lads. It means the world. If you ever need to stop, don't worry, you can stop. But if you want to help me out, please consider using the links below. I'd really appreciate it. It's you guys who help me do this stuff. You know, if it wasn't for you guys, I probably wouldn't be able to. I've put links to all the books I mentioned at the start in the description, so you can head over there and pick them up if you want, or on Audible. You can get a free trial using my link below and pick up one of the audiobooks there. I do recommend them. They are all pretty, pretty good. I will be pulling together an inquisitorial report kind of thing covering the entire history of Fabius Bile soon, as well as a bunch of other stuff. Until then, please do remember to like the video. Let me know what you think in the comments, and subscribe if you are not. Oh, and share this to anyone you think might be interested. That really, really helps. But, you know, just interaction in general is good for me and good for the channel. I'll see you next time. Thanks very much for watching. Again, I love this series. It is my standout favourite 40k series, without a doubt. Ever since the first book, I was just, like, struck at the quality of it, the ideas in it, the humour in it, the characterisations. It's amazing, you know. I don't even know how to fully, I don't know, it's quality. If you've not read the series, you need it in your life. It is genuinely good and brings 40k up to a new tier. You know, if you're into Heresy, this, and you've never really read sort of general 40k stuff, this is the book series to get into, to add to that for sure. But yeah, that's all I've got to say now, because I am just going to ramble again. I love the book too much. Fabius Bile is just amazing. And again, is it a convenient ending? Yeah, it is, but I don't know, man. I think it's a clever and neat way of wrapping up a bunch of issues and justifying the different versions of Fabius we've seen in other series. Like, I know he's in the Mephiston series. He's pretty much a different character to an extent. And other examples we've seen of him, he's just kind of a mad scientist, which is disappointing because this series has showed him with such depth. But anyway, I'm going to go. Thank you all again. Thanks for liking the stuff. And I'll be back again soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.